one of my favorite people to talk with about Shakespeare is director slash educator slash innovator Rob Miles, the co-founder of the Show Must Go Online, who is has the energy of 10 men and several women. And I, of course, in my teaching, I'm always looking for what's the reduced way to explain something to an audience. And I don't know whether you came up with this phrase or have repurposed it and borrowed it from somebody else, but your phrasing of tools, not rules, is such a great way of explaining how to approach not only Shakespeare's language, but acting generally. So well done, sir. Where did you come up with it? Now let's spend 15 minutes expanding on something that's pretty self-explanatory in three words.
Yes. Yeah. I think we finished, haven't we?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. I'm Austin Titchener, co-artistic director of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, now in its 18th year, number 923, Tools, Not Rules. Rob Miles is not only the co-creator of The Show Must Go Online, which did so much to help keep so many of us sane during that first year of pandemic isolation in 2020 with weekly Zoom productions of Shakespeare's plays in order of their composition. Rob also created the Shakespeare Deck, the very handy set of cards filled with exercises and suggestions for how actors can wield the full power of Shakespeare's words. Rob broke down what he means by the phrase tools, not rules, and how he discovered and expanded on this idea through his teaching and directing.
Basically, tools, not rules is a reactionary response to fundamentalism, really. There's a lot of people make a lot of bold claims about how to do Shakespeare right.
Yeah.
And the irony sends to me that the more you follow those rules, like commandments, the more trouble you find yourself getting into, because Shakespeare didn't know a rule that he didn't break, for a start. But I also think that there's a bit of Dunning-Kruger effect going on with some of these proclamations, where it's like a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. So things that I've genuinely heard drama teachers tell students is that everything is an iamb. So you have to rigidly do alternating stresses to the point where someone literally said, it's in one of Hamlet's speeches, looking before and after. And he went, no, looking before and after. You've got to emphasize the ing of looking over the look of looking, because that's iambic. And that's innately preposterous. And it's going to be a barrier. But the most important thing I always come back to with this is that will be a barrier to the audience's understanding. If I go, looking before and after, you'll go, there's a king? What? What's happening? And right, it will deliberately obfuscate your understanding. And you're already white-knuckling it as an audience, let's be honest.
Yeah, right? 100%.
A lot of your energy in just passing the meaning of what's being said. And one of the things I say to my actors is, have you seen Simone Biles, the Olympian? A gymnast? When you watch Simone Biles, she looks fluid and effortless, and she does impossible things, and she makes them look easy, and it's graceful, and it's moving, and it's everything that you want a performance to be. For Simone Biles, she's in a car crash. She's pulling 5 Gs. Her head is under her legs and over it again in half a second, right? The lived experience that she has as a performer is radically different to the received experience that her audience gets. And the same, I think, is true of playing Shakespeare. Ben Jonson said something about Shakespeare, that in order to write a good rhyme, you must sweat, right? Or a good line, sorry, you must sweat. And to say a good line, you must sweat also, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what I think is the problem with a lot of these proclamations, like everything is an iamb, is that they're energy-saving devices. They're stopping you interrogating the text any further. You just go, well, as long as I just bang them out alternatively and then I leave a pause at the end, which is the other bugbear I've got, then I'll be fine and I'm doing it right. So nothing can harm me. And it's a very lazy way of interacting with the text, because we know Shakespeare was taught rhythmic variations, and those were derived from the poetry of Spain and Italy and France and Latin, right? Where all of these things pre-existed. They're not unique to English. And then we know as well that Shakespeare, unlike his contemporaries, and Rob Stagg has written a good book. It's not for the academically faint of heart, I would say, but it's called Blankness and Alternate History. And he's literally charted the degree of variance of Shakespeare from his contemporaries in terms of using these other rhythmic variations within an iambic pentameter slab, if you like, right? Yeah. And it's really useful to know that those are in there, because you can see that they're in there if you're trying to make sense of what you're saying, which again is the gymnastics that you're doing so that the audience isn't having to work as hard because you're doing that job for them. So then the other rule that I hear a lot is pause at the end of every verse line, right? Yeah. Even if it completely knackers the sense. Because an audience in our world is trained that we pause at the end of a thought, right? Mm-hmm. And so they'll assume that the thought is complete, and then their brain will start to try and put sense together out of incomplete information in that suspension that you give them. And then if you break it up in that way, look, I've lost my thread slightly. Let me just roll back. So you're pausing at the end of every verse line, and you're breaking up the sense of a thought that might be connected. Now, Shakespeare, obviously all the punctuation is free to play for, right? We know that editors were involved in everything. However,
Shakespeare didn't write his own punctuation, yes.
Right. But generally speaking, first folio is worth trying on for size, because the actors that had lived experience of performing the plays were involved in editing that text. So generally speaking, if you want one to try on for size, that's a reasonable one to try on for size. However, in Latin, there's no punctuation, so you have to figure out where the sentences begin and end, essentially put your own in, right? And that's what actors would have been expected to do as well. So any punctuation was there as a rhetorical guide for how to speak it, right? So, the son for sorrow shall not show his head, has a full stop at the end. If it didn't have a full stop at the end, you could tell from context that the thought was complete.
Right.
So you would say it as a complete thought, you would breathe at the end of the verse line, and then you go on to the next one. That's the prince in Romeo and Juliet at the end of the play. So he's a high-status character. Everyone's dead, and he doesn't know any of them personally. So, of course, all of his thoughts are really uniform, iambic pentameter, with full thoughts contained within a single verse line. If it were done when it's done, then to a well, it were done quickly. What?
Yeah.
That doesn't work at all, right? Now, you could go, if it were done when it is done, then to a well, it were done quickly. And you can use other devices to try and pitch the rhythm into the air so that the audience can feel that there's another shoe to drop. But I would say, to what benefit?
Yeah.
If it were done when it is done, then to a well, it were done quickly. And then I'm going to breathe on the caesura, which I naturally do. So I think, you know, caesuras is a whole other thing. There's three different types. There's a masculine and a feminine, and then within the masculine, I believe, there's a lyric and an epic, which is where either the rhythm, where the punctuation takes the space of a slot in the meter, and then the rhythm resets after that, or not, and the rhythm just carries on uninterrupted, right? So this is, the reason that I'm just like throwing facts down is because the more you know, the more fluid your relationship with these tropes becomes, because then you realize, okay, so there's a full stop in the middle of the line. Does that mean anything in and of itself? No, it means there's more investigation to do. So now I'm going to look at, does it come after a soft or a strong stress? Or it comes after one of those. And if that's the case, what follows on? Does the rhythm continue uninterrupted, or does it sound suddenly very janky after that full stop? Well, that tells me that I should take a pause and therefore most probably a breath, right? So by being armed with a lot of this quite granular technical rhetorical knowledge, you start to gain an appreciation for how this stuff can be useful to you as a speaker. But there is never a time where that is, what's that line from Anchorman? 50% of the time it works every time, or something like that, right?
Yeah.
That's basically all of these things. So very quickly, when I was putting together the Shakespeare deck, I called it a toolkit for actors. Mm-hmm. Thinking of it like a utility belt, you know, like a plumber or an electrician might have, right? And from that derived tools, not rules. Because if you're a plumber or a joiner or an electrician, you know what the rules are. You know what, in a perfect world, you would do. And then you get confronted with the messy reality of the job that you have to fix. Because it's not going to fix itself. And you have to use your ingenuity, creativity, critical faculties, lived experience to figure out what the optimal solution for that situation is. And it's exactly the same with Shakespeare. And I think anyone that sells you anyone that sells you rules where you always do this and that's always correct is shortcutting you and is going to, you're going to end up with egg on your face if you follow that religiously. There are some quite high up figures within Shakespeare teaching and practice that will push this doctrine on people, I guess, because it's what they have received.
It's easier that way. It's just easier and lazy. It's easier and lazier.
And I think it also comes from like being in the wrong tradition. Because I think a lot of that stuff came from literary appraisals of Shakespeare texts. And it's I don't really have an interest as a director or performer in showing an audience the page through the power of my voice. Like the audience doesn't need to know where the line endings are. The verse is a map for the actor to be able to eke the sense out in the way that they evoke the words through the voice.
Yeah, so, these words are meant to be spoken, not read.
Exactly. Said, not read. On your feet and out loud is another one that I always say. And for the first time, cold read it on your feet and out loud, and you'll learn more from the mistakes you make doing that than you will trying to intellectualize it. So,
such a great point.
Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
And you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Podcast.
What?
Yes. Merrily and yay verily, motherfucker.
Where can you RSC the RSC? This fall of 2024, we'll be performing our special election edition of The Complete History of America Abridged in Illinois, Maryland, Virginia, Kentucky, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Colorado. Check out the touring page at our website, ReducedShakespeare.com, or our social media pages for venue and ticket information. Now back to my conversation with Rob Miles, the creator of both The Show Must Go Online and The Shakespeare Deck, talking about the excellent lesson of tools, not rules. I mean, there are so many exceptions. I mean, I know a lot of the rules, too. There are so many exceptions to the rules. They might not as well be rules.
Yes and no. So this is where I think the rules can sometimes be helpful. They can draw your attention to things that otherwise you might miss. So an eye like Mars to threaten and command is a line in Hamlet. And the word and, which is a nothing preposition, is in a strong stress position. But then you go, an eye like Mars to threaten and command. And suddenly that empowers both the words either side of it because it puts them in a little set of weighing scales. And you go, who do you threaten? Enemies. Who do you command? Allies. Right. So the image that I'm creating of Mars and what Mars's eye is capable of has just doubled in size. It's not just scaring people. It's threatening these people and commanding these people. But if I go, an eye like Mars to threaten and command, you will think threaten and command are more or less the same thing and intended for the same audience. So if you follow the meter, it will reveal to you things that otherwise you might not necessarily see that can help you get extra juice out of the orange, so to speak.
Well, and I like to do that just by counting five stresses. I don't care where the stresses land, but I need five of them, you know? And sometimes, it can be, and, oh, that's a great idea. Because that also points out another rule that I loathe, which is never emphasize a pronoun.
Oh, come on. Again, if you look at the meter, when he wants you to emphasize a pronoun, they're in conventional strong stress
This rule of never emphasizing pronouns just goes against the idea of antithesis, which you and I have talked about so much, is that Shakespeare loves this play of antithesis, black or white, dark, a day or a night, now to then, me to you.
The cool version of that rule, right, is are you comparing yourself to someone else or two people to each other or whatever? Right. If you are, then by all means, emphasize the personal pronoun. The problem comes in when you go, they pluck out my eyes.
Yeah, right.
And with no one else's eyes than it could be. We weren't talking about plucking anyone else's eyes out. And that's how you know if it's the right thing to do or not. But nine times out of ten, those personal pronouns tend to be in strong stress positions in the verse. And there's examples in Julius Caesar of this, because I think it's Cassius says something to the effect of, you know, Brutus would stir a man, you know, Brutus's name would stir a man as well as he. It's in that last strong stress position at the end of the line, purposefully, because like you say, it's me and you, it's Brutus and Caesar, right? Yeah. They're being weighed against each other. So of course it's helpful to emphasize the personal pronouns in that case. It's the death of subtlety to make any absolute proclamations, right?
Right, and to say that something is not a rule doesn't mean that the opposite is always a rule, you know. Too.
Yeah.
You know, it's what you say. It's what you've done so brilliantly with the Shakespeare deck. These are all tools for you to use or not use within a given situation. And same with acting. Like, I've had people ask me, what school of acting do you adhere to? And I'm like, none, all of them. Yeah, whatever works in the moment.
100%. Yeah, no, I am very much a magpie. Anything that's shiny from various traditions, I will steal. I think the only deficit, again, of the different methods is that I don't think even necessarily the practitioners claimed this, but their proponents have since seemed to do this idea that these are catch-all solutions, that it's a complete system. Whereas it just can't be true. There's loads of useful stuff in Stanislavski, but it's not enough to do everything all the time. Right. Meisner worked incredibly well in certain situations, including in Shakespeare, if you want to fuck around with where you're going to put the emphasis in one thing and another, right? You can use the repetition exercise from Meisner quite well in Shakespeare. But other aspects of it kill it dead, because if you try and improvise your way around Shakespeare, you'll never find your way back to the lines. You know, you've got to invest yourself in the tech that you've got in order for it to go well.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, except for one more thing, which I'll share with you in about 60 seconds, so stick around. The entire collection of the Show Must Go Online productions of Shakespeare's plays are available to watch on YouTube, and Rob's Shakespeare Deck is available at his website, Rob Miles, that's Miles with a Y, robmiles.co.uk. Then send us your handy tips via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com or throw a comment to us over on the socials or on our own actual website, reducedshakespeare.com, or visit my website, theshakespearience.com. Thanks as always to aging learned pedant Matthew Croke, web services by Ginger Power Limited, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Patrick Bannon. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Francis Callier and Angela V. Shelton, known collectively as Frangela, who can be seen this Saturday night in Chicago just ahead of next week's Democratic National Convention as part of their Sexy Liberal Tour. Go to frangela.com for more information. And as always, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 923 2769ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
It feels like the only tool we need to adhere to regarding Shakespeare is to go out and buy Rob Miles's Shakespeare deck. Am I right about that?
Nicely done, sir. Nicely done.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to ReduceShakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.